We're going to kick off our post-lunch afternoon with a dual presentation. We were really lucky to get an encore presentation from Rick with SumaCare. He gave a version of this presentation in May of last year for our risk management and compliance events. So that room was filled with, we had some CFOs, we had a lot of risk management officers, we had a few compliance officers. And I mean, you guys should have seen it. They're like, what? Risk adjustment? Exposes me to risk? and Rick's all, So it was wonderful. So I know that you'll definitely feel the support of the peeps in the room today. And then we've coupled Rick with Denise, who is hiding over here in the corner, from Dynamic. Matt had alluded to the work that Dynamic's been doing in the EDPS and RAPS reconciliation work. And so we invited them to come along and share from their perspective some of the things that they're seeing as well. So really looking forward to this presentation. I hope you guys are as well. And I think we left an hour 15 for this one. And we are going to try really hard to stay on schedule so that we end at 5 today, because I know everybody will want that break before dinner. So, all right. Rick?
I'll move it real quick for everybody. And I will give Dynamics a little plug here. We did see their demo on their old system. We haven't seen the new, upgraded version of it. But I know our technical people, our RAPS people, and, everybody really thought it was a great system. We couldn't get our financial people to back us on getting it, though. So, once again, we did it internal. All right, so anybody that doesn't know me, I'm Rick Alexanch. I'm from SumaCare in Akron, Ohio. Our claim to fame is we're right down the street from the Football Hall of Fame to the south, and on the north, the Cleveland Hall of Fame Rock Museum. So, which one do I want to hit?
Side to side.
Oh, side to side? There we go. So, I'm not smarter than the technology. But anyways, we'll do a quick overview of SumaCare, which I'll fly through. I want to do a little bit of a historical review on risk adjustment, get into risk mitigation, and then we'll conclude with our checklist and go into questions and answers. This is our building. It's about, it was built in 92, so it's starting to show a little age, but it's not a bad place to work. Nice offices and good conditions. I'm not going to spend a lot of time, but SumaCare is into multiple product lines, or we've got multi-state accounts and self-contained operations right in the building for everything. Just kind of number of employees and employer groups and our lives that we cover. Different products. My forte is Medicare, but I have been thrown into the exchange to do the risk adjustment in RADV, only because we had no one else. So, all right, quick question to get us started. Does anybody know who the finance administration was that set up the Healthcare Finance Administration, and what year, what secretary basically did that? Any guesses? Pardon me? No, but that's a good guess. So I'll tell you what, you can have a prize for that. So, there we go. Anyways, it was Secretary Califano in 1977, and it was basically to get the National Healthcare Program rolling. So if you guys could pass that hat on the way back. See, I give prizes out for right and wrong answers, so don't be shy. All right. So where we're diving into this is for managed care, where we really started getting involved with the federal government. Basically, it all been on fee-for-service. They were looking for a new way to put this program together, and they wanted to know what cost utilization was going on with the members, and they just said fee-for-service wasn't the way to track it. When they got into this, so it was based on, basically, a lot of it was demographics, sex, age, and where you live. They included dual statuses and things like that. What they found out with the program is there was favorable selection when it started. People would try to get the healthier members because since everything was basically based on hospital inpatients, there wasn't a lot to it. So you had a healthy member, you were usually getting paid about the same as non-healthy. So one of the tests that they would actually do in the early days is they would hold like meetings for potential members, and you'd have to climb steps, you know, to go to the meeting to see how people got winded and things like that. So, and I guess I am dating myself. I'm getting a little old here. So, but fun fact, does anyone know what the original managed care model was before it was called the HCC model? It's well. It was actually called the PIP, DCG, Principal Inpatient, because they just looked at, you know, the inpatient. All right. So when we look at the PIP model, if payments are based on inpatients, you know, it was being slowly phased in at 10% based on what they found, and the other 90% on the demographics model. CMS had some observations, when they're admitting it, you know, the model only explains 6% of the variation of healthcare costs. And that is a key one because CMS wanted to know what was going on with the population through Medicare. So they wanted to get better understanding, so they kept looking for it. Now, here's another question. So, you know, just to kind of do it. Fun fact, there was another, you know, CMS basically, before they were called CMS, was the Healthcare Financing Administration. In 2001, they changed the name to CMS. But there was another name that was really under consideration before they even went with CMS. Does anybody know it? And I'll give you a clue. Think of Mother's Day. All right? Think of your mother. Somebody said mama. That's a prize winner. There we go. Can you hear me? All right. Yeah, it was actually called, was going to be named the Medicare and Medicaid Administration, MAMA. Now, they didn't go with this name because they thought it was really going to be a little insulting to people and overprotective. So it got washed away. And probably a good thing for us. All right. So as the PIP, you know, model continues to develop, you know, we're transitioning to a risk-based system. It was based on originally the ICD-9 codes. Major shortcoming, only illnesses at hospital, as we alluded to earlier. Reduced admissions means healthier members. So, you know, to correct this issue, they said, we got to start including everything. So they were looking at outpatient. They were looking at all the physicians. So a new model was born, the HCC model. And it got phased in from 2004 through 2007. And if anybody remembers, that's when they went with the 30, 50, 70% until they actually got it in. So quick history, 1999, prior demographics model was used. 2000, you know, the PIP model came into play. In 2004, CMS implemented a HCC model that was a blended system that worked its way through. In 2007... something we all feared, you know, CMS implements the RADV, and they went with a pilot of 5 plans, and they targeted another 32 contracts. I know when they were doing this, I was worried because if they came in and they found this, I'm thinking, all right, they're going to take money back. What is my CFO going to say to me? And he's going to say, why didn't you warn me? And so I started raising flags where I worked real quickly about it. But at the time, nobody really took it that seriously. It was just being implemented. In 2008, though, they came in and they said, we're going to start extrapolating plans now. And we're going to start seeing a little of the history of how this really worked. Late 2008, actuaries actually estimate that the plan have issues and errors with their codes from the providers up to 30% based on those claims. That's a high number of errors. So CMS is saying, you know what? We're going to really go out and start looking at, you know, this RADV process. But in 2009, and some of you people mentioned this before, you know, for the 2007 risk adjustment data validation audits that were performed, CMS recovered $13.7 million in overpayments. And some of you guys contributed to that, those payments. Late in 2010, CMS announces major changes coming to the risk adjustment. You know, they're going to shift away from our traditional standard wraps that we all love because it's a nice reduced, you know, set of information that we gave the government to 5010 that has a, you know, a couple thousand elements, all kind of edit checks and rejects, and, you know, If you can't manage this yourself, that's when you should look at a good vendor to come in and help you out with your EDPS. And I won't plug, you know, anybody in the room, even though there are some good packages here. For 2011, you know, risk adjustment data validations audits come back again. 30 plans are selected. Unlike the 2007 audits, the payment error is calculated with extrapolation. For this reason, you know, CMX is looking to obtain a lot more money from these audits. 2012, CMS is requiring health plans to submit, you know, 5010 encounter data that we were talking about. You know, this is not a fun process. I know we've been working, like, you know, really hard at our plan on this, try to get our error rates down, get all the information. We use Milliman, who basically did some comparison studies. We were at an 8% rate. We're just now around a 2.9%, so showed a lot of improvement. We're still going for stuff, but we have, you know, thanks to CMS, they extended the deadline for the EDPS, for the dates of service of 2015, and instead of January 31st, we now have to May 1st, so we're working to get that data leakage really down. So late 2015, ICD-10s come into the picture, you know, which once again, you get a good coding staff who know your ICD-9s, know how the process goes. Time to retrain and retool. All right, 2015 continues the contract level RADV process, and other plans are selected. 2016, guess what? We got another model, another change, and they've done this over the different periods of times, but this is where they're going with the dual eligible process. So now you've got your full duals, your partials, your age-in duals, and so, you know, it's a blended model to make things a little more complex and complicated for the plans, try to figure out what your risk dollars are going to be. But the future is really tied into the EDPS system. In 2016, you know, we're getting 90% on wraps, 10% on encounters. 2017, they increased it to 25% for EDPS. Now, in 18, that was supposed to go up to 50%, but if you saw the call letter that came out, CMS pushed it back down and said, we're going to keep it wraps at 75% and EDPS at 25% because there are errors and flaws in their logic on selecting the risk adjustment records. They also are looking for comments, if anyone wants to send them in, where you can tell them that, you know, based upon EDPS, they should be paying plans some additional fee because of their error rates and that they're shortchanging us. For 2019 and 20, CMS is rethinking what those rates should be. They haven't said they're going to change yet, but they're pondering the thought. All right, another fun fact, here we go. Which president thought health maintenance organizations would help contain the growth in healthcare spending? So this is a multiple choice, so we're going to have people guess in here. Was it President Clinton? Was it President Nixon? Was it President Reagan? What do you guys think? Anybody? Nixon. That's close. Anybody else? Reagan, that's really close. Anybody else? If you say all of the above, you're right. So anybody want to claim that answer? Or I know you wanted a bag if you want to claim the bag. There you go. That's fine. So, but you know, all these presidents really did think that, you know, the health plans, you know, are really going to do something with this model and, you know, get it in, you know, get every their costs in line and projections. I think we've done a great job of helping Medicare members. But, you know, we still have work to do on cost reduction. And I do believe that there is some out there. But, you know, when you look at different statistics, you know, everybody can make them work in their favor. All right. CMS creates a health risk payment methodology, you know, used basically to use a diagnosis codes for HCCs. There's been a lot of tweaks on this. There's been different models. They redirect diagnosis codes from one HCC to another and back and forth. They use, you know, different models, two different models, same year. So you got 25-75% splits. You know, it's just been a very complex process for plans to stay on top of. And I don't know if you're like us, but our CFO goes, I just want to know one thing. Tell me the dollars that it's all going to tie. And you're like, you know, you've got interactions upon everything with the diseases. And so we come up and we give estimates, but we always ask him not to hold them to us. But, you know, he likes to dangle our feet out under the fire. So once again, Medicare plans are required to submit, you know, the claims data in that format we talked about, which is a nice WRAPS format. It's a reduced instruction set, so it makes everything easy. You know, CMS expects the plans on this payment to basically extrapolate the right type of records, you know, and basically get everything submitted within the appropriate time frames. So there's basically a lag on that data when you're submitting it. You know, and you need to make sure that, you know, the encounters are truly eligible. And when you're looking at that submission of the claims records through this WRAPS process, this is where risk mitigation really starts, knowing how to get your records submitted appropriately. All right, so payments are recalculated every 6 months using a rolling 12-month data service. Not all claim encounters are eligible for risk adjustment, and I think I did all that, so. The first rung in risk mitigation strategy is to filter all your claim data meet CMS standards. So you're going to look for inpatient, outpatient. You're going to look at the appropriate type of bills on what should be submitted. Then for your physician, your provider records, you got to make sure that it's the right specialty and, you know, you're sitting out and weeding all the ones out that should not be going through. Now, there's additional encounter filters that I know that have come along through supplementary WRAPS, you know, user groups calls that we've talked about. So if anybody's been on those, in the past they would talk about, you know, lab codes and radiology codes that you need to weed these out. So once again, you know, plans have different ways of looking at this, filtering those codes. But you know what? It's a really good idea to, you know, dive in deep because we thought we had it covered. Gotta watch your mic here, because we were eliminating all these by specialty type. Then we got a national RADV, and all of a sudden, we said, how did this lab code get through? We get rid of them. It came from a PCP. They had their own equipment and, you know, testing facilities to do it. They submitted some rollouts, and sure enough, it got selected for the national RADV, but it made us smarter because we went back then and we created code to go through and search for orphan codes that were basically labs and things like that and radiology from, you know, our PCPs so we could weed those out up front. All right. Basically, CMS expects plans to submit WRAPS records quarterly. I know as a safety precaution, we do it monthly, and we also find it an easier way of getting through the process. So what we really do is we're looking for duplicate errors. They had a big thing for a while. If you went over 5% error, you know, duplicate errors, that they were going to start dinging plans. And so we actually pull out and do a manual review. But we also, while we are doing that, we look at and make sure our dates of service are there. And one of the things in our early days we discovered is we were having some date of birth issues with CMS. I had to sit there and argue with our IT people to pull that out. I said, don't put it. Well, it's no problem to put it in. I said, yeah, it is. When it's wrong, they're dinging us and not counting that WRAPS record. And it's optional, so don't put it in. So CMS has established the timetables. As you guys know, there's basically two main ones that we deal with, the mid-year and then the final reconciliation. And these payments could be really big to health plans, especially, you know, if you're going out and doing retrospective chart reviews. And that's why, you know, I wish our CFO was still here, because I know our CFO is finally getting that, and I've been preaching to him to come to the Health Plan Alliance meetings, but I'm still nudging him along the way. So what we also do is we create and maintain a control log of every file submission that we do, with the results that come back on the reps, returns, files, so we can track it, look at the 5%, see if we can see any inconsistencies, you know, from one production run to another, to make sure that nothing odd is happening and that we're getting everything submitted appropriately. The second run, you know, in risk mitigation, and I kind of touched on what this before, is we've taken it to that step where we've developed things to look for those members that are those records that are orphans for the different codes. So we really kind of stay on top of looking at all this. And once again, we created our own manual processes and some access databases in my unit that we do before, you know, IT creates a main file, then we load it in and we run and check all this in order to make sure that, you know, they're not just letting anything fly through. I don't know if your IT department's like ours, but ours says, hey, we just program after that. You know, it's up to the user department to make sure everything's okay. So third rung in risk mitigation strategy is to perform the medical chart reviews, and I'm sure everybody has done this. And you can select, you know, for risk mitigation any which way you want. You know, you could look at, you know, a random selection. You could target certain categories, or you could just do totally blind reviews. Now, we've tried combinations of all these and found that they've really worked. But what our clinical team has come back and said is where they see the biggest, you know, bang for risk, you know, mitigation is on cancer, pulmonary embolism, and vascular disease. And what they do is we take those three codes now and we search and find, you know, the orphan records that were coming in through PCPs only. Because think about it, if someone has cancer, they should be going to an oncologist specialist and you should be getting records there. So if it's only coming in from a PCP, does that mean it's a history of? Well, 90% of the cases we found that is true. The other 10% we found, guess what, we have an older member, and they just basically have said, hey, listen, I am not going through chemo, I'm not doing this, I'm whatever, 90 years old, and I'm just going to live the rest of my life out. So once again, some of them are actually okay. But like I said, 90% did get weeded out. So you really need a basic understanding of how the RADV process works, what CMS expects from plans. Unlike other Medicare audits, though, you know, the RADV is so much tougher because, as we heard today, hey, I think it's a good record, you know, I see the chart, I read it, and then, you know, another certified coder says, no, I wouldn't do it. So it kind of goes back and forth. And you really need to have those processes where you do overreads on the first reviewer to try to make sure that everything is coming out correct. So CMS tries to use the RADV to, you know, make sure the accuracy that we're submitting as a plan is, you know, up to par. Everything that's being collected is looking good. Now, one of the things we did find out from CMS, because we had providers that were saying, we're not going to participate in this. They said, if it's for a RADV process, they have to participate. Now, I don't know how you enforce that, but in my opinion, and once again, I know our provider relations people didn't like it. I said, they don't want to participate. I just want to call CMS and say, hey, I got provider A saying, I'm not going to do it. You know, tell me what you want done. And, you know, they said, no, we're the provider-friendly insurance company. You could never do that. So I don't know, you know, how to get around it. But there's basically two types of RADV audits. You've got the national, and then you've got your contract level. The intent behind the RADV, you know, we look and ensure the integrity and accuracy is there. We verify the diagnosis codes, you know. CMS selects the health plans for RADV on an annual basis, as everyone knows. And, you know, we're required to submit medical records to validate those DIAG codes. Now, for the national RADV, they select around 600 members across the entire spectrum of the MA program. So, you know, probably 90% of the plans usually get selected, since the last count I had, there were around 600 plans, and usually they just select one or two per, you know, so not everybody gets selected, but the bulk of us do. And, you know, the thing about it is this is a safe zone audit, because you can find issues in your plan, that you can go off and correct, and you're not going to have to pay a penalty, and there's no extrapolation. Now, on the contract level, it gets a little more tricky. They select 30 plans a year, which is about 5% of all plans. You know, they have random, but they also have targeted. So what you want to watch on is, you know, if you're targeted, sometimes it's just because you have past violations. You know, sometimes it's because, you know, CMS sees that, you know, your risk score went from 0.9 to 1.7, and they're like, okay, what the heck happened here? So they want to make sure that everything's good. Sometimes it's because you fail to comply with, you know, records in the National RADV. So there's 201 members they select for this. And then they rank them from highest to lowest and come up with three tiers, high, medium, low. And they take 67 members in each of those and review them with the plans. So remember, though, the key here, this is a danger zone because results are extrapolated now to the plan level. All right, the universe. All Medicare members who were continuously enrolled for that data collection year and at least had one HCC get put into it, but they excluded ESRD patients and hospice patients. That National RADV, you know, sample of members, you know, when we look at it, equal number of enrollees are sampled from the different stratas, you know. For then, like I said, the national, there are 600, you know, beneficiaries from all eligible, and 200 enrollees are selected from each strata that they do. Contract level, we talked about the risk stratification for the beneficiaries here also, and they go from highest to lowest. Strata is based on disease component of the risk scores across all eligible enrollees, and we talked about those. An equal number of enrollees are sampled from the three strata, you know, the 201, 67 from each strata. Now, here are some of the warning indicators. Large increases, you know, in plan over year risk score. So if your risk score is jumping up, we talked about the 5% threshold. If you're continuously over 5% duplicates, CMS says you got an issue with your operations, which means you could have an issue with your submissions. And then the last one is if you don't ever submit any redacts, and a redact is a delete of a diag that you don't believe qualifies, CMS is also looking at those redacts per plan. So make sure that you try to cover yourself and do some type of risk mitigation on that. Other actions that your plans received, you know, for audits that were not passed, you know, if you're sitting there and you're belligerent with the CMS officials and arguing with them and saying you're wrong, not good to do. And believe me, you would think that's common sense, but I've sat in some meetings where somebody in the claims department says, I do a great job. What do you mean we have an issue? Yeah, and it's like, hey, just calm down and let's move on. Now, the success to the whole program is people. And a lot of people that are here today, you know, that presented to you this morning, there are your key success factors, the ones that are know that's what's actually going on and helping to remedy the problem, going that extra mile and looking at it. And so, first of all, we should get RADV support from the top down. You know, it shouldn't be, you know, a middle manager going to the top and saying, we need to do this, we need to do this, we need to do this. And some of you in plans may have experienced that because, yes, I have. And so I'm Mr. Chicken Little running around to our CFO constantly letting him know what goes on. And he's actually starting to attend some of the webinars. He goes, I never realized this. And we're like, well, I'm glad you are now. So try to build good, you know, team memberships among everybody so you can get this done. Always be polite and courteous, you know. Other key successes, you know, plans must fully understand the RADV process and what's expected from the chart chase. And I think from listening today, I think you guys have a really good handle on it. So you identify, pursue, and collect, you know, your medical records in a very short time frame. And if you miss that time frame, CMS isn't going to expand it, so make sure you get it in. Don't wait till the last minute either, because CDAT could be down that last week when everybody's trying to cram them in, or there could be problems with other things with it. All right, you know, I know we try to establish operational requirements to, you know, meet different things. We've only been selected for the national, thank goodness. We haven't had the contract level, but you know, you really need to get your tools in place to identify, you know, your target chases, do it in an efficient manner, and get a, you know, work through the process in order to have that success ratio. Develop project timelines and review them with people. If you're behind, don't be afraid to go to your CFO and say, hey, listen, we should have half of our charts by now, and we've got like, you know, 20%. We're going to need, you know, our chief medical officer to start intervening and helping us along here. Develop your talking points, you know. Ensure senior management really communicates the importance of the RADV to the entire company. It shouldn't just be left on two or three people. Understand, you know, the CMS system, the rules, the data flows, you know. Download the documents from CDAT as soon as you get, you know, the call for it, you know. Look at and get their HIPAA fact sheets. Look at the hospital and physician letters that they put out, you know. Get yourself your good checklist. You know, if you need to do assistations, make sure you have the forms. Have a good RADV team. Manage, you know, the clinical coding efforts, you know. Upload charts with the established naming conventions. You've heard people talk about having to do it twice or three times. Yeah, my first time I did it for CDAT for the National RADV, I thought I was great. I had all this information. I uploaded it and I looked. Oh, gosh, I had my own naming convention. And it's like, oh, I had to redo it. I felt really, you know, kind of dumb on that. But, you know, you learn from your mistakes, so make sure you try. You determine the best medical record. Get consensus from your coders. And, you know, that's harder than you think, because I know just on the national, you know, they said, oh, this is a better record. This is a better record. I'm the manager. Make your decision. I'm not clinical. I'm there like, okay, guys, help me out here. Which way do I want to go? Once a RADV process is over, there's some post-activities that you can perform to determine the best strategies. Look what worked for your plan, what didn't work, you know? Go through it. All right, so just real quickly, here's a quick checklist. You know, have a well-defined, you know, project plan with a detailed timeline. Identify the resources, you know, on the audit team, the roles and responsibilities. You know, make sure you get your IT people involved, your claims people, your clinical people, you know, whatever it takes to get this project done, you want to do it to the best of your ability. Once the audit's received, you know, execute your work plan as quickly and as efficiently as possible. You know, use your claims and encounters to identify any likely chart chases, you know. And eliminate providers who don't meet the criteria, because I know we have one older provider that's like about 90 years old, and he does everything on paper, and he says, I'm not signing charts. I never have. I never will. And I'm thinking, one day CMS is going to come and get you, you know. But complete the RADV process by the end of the 15th week to give you some extra time with the CDAT system. And there we are for questions and answers. So who has a question here? Okay, can we pass this back to that gentleman there, because he has asked a question.
Great, thank you. So my question is, for National RADV, I know there is no penalty.
Right.
But on a contract level RADV, if there is an unsubstantiated HCC, how long before you see the adjustment on your MMR after the finding?
Well, I'll tell you what. I think that is an excellent question, because I think those time frames have ballooned out, because as what we've saw by the first RADVs, it's like 4 years later that, you know, CMS is coming out with a ruling, because once again, I think plans, you know, challenge it. You go into appeals. Some have gone into court battles with CMS. So I think CMS, you know, is really trying to refine this process so they don't have to go through a lot of what they've been going through in the past. Now, I don't know if any of the plans that actually went through the contract level RADV would like to, you know, comment on that any further, but it would be appreciated.
Hold on. Oh, good. That's right. I used to have one attached to me. Yeah, it did take like 4 years. And I'm not sure. And then I, when I was looking back at our notes, I didn't realize I did find what our financial penalty was. But I'm not sure how that actually worked when they took it back and everything.
Pass it back and forth. So when we got our results, they gave us that spreadsheet where it said, you know, if anything was discrepant. And then you had the opportunity to provide a dispute or not. For the ones that you did not provide a dispute on, then they took that back pretty quickly after that. Oh, thank you. And then after they went through the ones that you sent a dispute on, if you didn't appeal those, then they took the rest of the money back. So it was in two separate increments for us because we didn't appeal anymore.
I just wanted a clarification. With the overpayment remedy ticket process, in the past, the national audits didn't have, and they still don't have, any financial extrapolation, but when you go through the audit and you identify one of these HCCs that's not valid, that is, in my mind, that's identifying an overpayment. So it's a small overpayment, but you, given the new methodology, you need to make sure to submit those discrepant HCCs once you get the final report as overpayments through that overpayment remedy ticket process, because that could theoretically be one of the red flags that would pop up if you go through the process and not submit those HCCs as deletes.
That's an excellent point, you know, and I think that's what you really need to consider for a lot of these. I know in the past on our national RADVs, you know, like I said, the early one we came up and found the one with, you know, the lab code that had gone through, and we kind of remedied that situation. This last time around, you know, for last year, what we found is we did have a, you know, they selected us for two records. One flew great, the other one didn't, and I had mixed reviews from our coders on that one. But basically, to give you an update, it was an anesthesiologist. And I don't know where they had a face-to-face visit with this member, so that qualifies there. Anesthesiology is an acceptable specialty code. They put the person under, but before they did, they sat there and talked to them and started jotting all these things down that they thought they had. Well, it's great that it went through, but when you stop and look at it, what follow-up is that anesthesiologist going to do? If that information doesn't flow to his PCP to really find out if he has these conditions... So one of our coders said, it's a face-to-face visit, right person, it's documented there. And the other one said, there's no treatment or follow-up. It's not. So, and CMS actually came back this time and rejected it. So what we went ahead and did is we put in a redact for it, just to, you know, even though it's after the timeline, we figure it's sitting out there. Whenever CMS takes it, they'll take it and ding us. But, you know, it's better to be safe. But you bring up a valid point on that. I'm sorry, somebody else wanted to...
Yeah, just one follow-up question. We submitted a delete file in June of last year, and we haven't seen an adjustment on our MMR.
Sorry, now I have to do the awkward mic passing.
So when... going on the rolling schedule of the submissions, if those deletes were for a prior payment year, so you're past the applicable sweep state, as they call it in the overpayment regulation, then it doesn't get incorporated until they do their risk adjustment rerun. So we get the final payment in August or July for the prior payment year, and then they will do periodic. I don't think there's a specific time frame for them, but they'll do a rerun of that payment year, and at that point, those will come through on the MMR as I had the adjustment reason code memorized. I don't have it memorized. Something like that where it's the rerun. So you'll see it come through there. And another thing to note with that, my experience was not paying back from these audits or any of the results. It was more of a deduction from on the plan payment report for what you're receiving as a result of these deletes.
And one thing I do want to mention, because, for example, you got to look at what year you're doing, but We did redax for 2014, and we estimated it was going to be around $900,000 they needed to take back on our redax. And a good portion of that never came through, period. Even when they did their final reconciliation, we went back and tried to figure out why. Well, if you remember, for 2014, they took EDPS, and CMS basically said, hey, we're going to give you whatever we find there. And guess what? Because our process wasn't sophisticated enough to be able to send deletes in on the EDPS world, they took it off on the RAPS world and then gave us credit on most of that stuff because, you know, they had it there. So it was like it washed it all out. So we're holding on our financial books those dollars because we're eventually going to have our process in play where we can send in the deletes. And we are going to go back and send them in for 2014 because even though the period's closed and done on the EDPS side, they're still accepting those records. And now for 2015, we also have redax where we estimated them about, you know, close to 700,000 for this 2015 dates of service. And we know 90% of that should be taken back. And we're going to have to hold 10% of it back for the EDPS world because, once again, we still don't have that delete process, you know, completed. So you need to look at all those type of things and make sure that you stay on top of the process. And I look at it more, like I said, I'm more of an IT. I used to be an IT director, so I develop code, reports, programs. I'm not clinical, so once again, I rely a lot on our certified coders, and they both got certified in HCC coding, so... Anybody else? Because I know I don't want to chew up all the time for the second half of this presentation. So any other questions before we move on? Well, I want to thank everybody, and I'll turn it over. And here you go. I can still have one.
Jess is my mole.
Here you go. I don't want to take these home, so... I have the clicker. Yeah, I'm a control freak.
I click this one right here?
Yeah, the side.
Perfect. So, hi, I'm Denise Chef Crittenden, and I work with Dynamic Healthcare Systems. And I'm going to dovetail off of Rick's presentation. I'm going to go into overpayments. So today, what I'm going to review is understanding overpayments in the health plan role, and this is from a global perspective of actual overpayments, not deletes, not RADV. The timelines, how to submit, what your risk areas are for overpayments, mitigating that risk internally, and it's an ongoing process. And then I have some frequently asked questions, and hopefully we'll have some time left for discussion and questions. So does everybody know about this ACA requirement, the overpayment rule that's tied to the False Claims Act? Can I see a show of hands of people who understand this one? So effective July 22, 2014, CMS is allowing those submissions for all identified overpayments or deletes outside of those applicable reconciliation periods, and it's the 6 years back in the reruns. Yeah, I wasn't gonna make you guys feel sorry for me, but... I will take a sip of this. Anyway, so the term overpayment, it has an actual legal definition, which is here on the screen. But really, in a nutshell, it's any funds received and retained outside of the applicable reconciliation period. So those funds, they put you at risk to be in the False Claims Act, a violation of the False Claims Act. And that comes with big penalties and even possibly jail time. So I don't know about you guys. I don't look good in orange. I'm going to take some time and look at this. The identified overpayment is the Medicare Advantage or any health plan's responsibility to identify these on their own with the use of reasonable diligence. Has anybody heard of a court case called Kane versus New York? Got a show of hands, a couple people, a couple nods. So in that court case, this is where they decided this plan, I'm not going to say their name, you guys can look it up and read about it, but they had a system glitch, and they knew about the system glitch, and they didn't report all of the erroneous data that actually went through and they got paid on. there was a whistleblower in the case, like there's is oftentimes when there's large amounts of money. And the government and the judge said plans have to use reasonable diligence to determine if they are submitting overpayments, receiving funds, and holding on to them when there is erroneous data or errors involved in this. And so this is to prevent reckless disregard also. You'll hear those. So in Chapter 7 of the Medicare Management Manual, if you guys have never looked at the risk adjustment chapter, it talks about all the components of risk adjustment data that is allowable for submission. And so they want to make sure that plans are providing accurate data and that they're using the appropriate integrity to make sure that the data is documented appropriately in the records so that their submissions are not an error. They want to make sure that plans understand that there's acceptable sources of data, and those are the hospital inpatient facilities, the hospital outpatient facilities, and physicians. And there's long lists of what these really mean, and there's CPT codes connected to these as well. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But it's the responsibility of the health plan to make sure that they comply with this guidance and this regulation, and that they're responsible for sending deletes. Federal regulations, as we talked about attestations. So federal regulations really dictate that there's a CEO or a CFO or somebody in the plan who is a delegated person to actually, with each submission of data for payment, they're actually going to sign and certify that this is true and accurate, and we take responsibility for any information that we may find later and send that in through as deletes. They have the same type of thing for the overpayment process. So, what are the overpayment timelines? It's a little fuzzy and it's a little bit complicated, as you guys may have heard, but really, CMS is allowing deletes to be submitted as overpayments back 6 years from the last completed payment year, or what they're calling the applicable reconciliation period. They've also published these rerun dates. And this is a calendar of those rerun dates. I'm not going to get into the nuts and bolts, but it's in your presentation. You can take a peek at it. So how do you submit an overpayment? And by overpayment, I'm talking a true overpayment. This is outside of your regular risk runs, your sweep periods, your cutoff dates. It's outside of a RADV because RADV doesn't apply to this. And so how do you do that? You have to identify them and open a remedy ticket. And so if somebody spoke to that back here. So there's a remedy ticket process. It has been a little bit tweaked. So currently the remedy ticket process is the 1-800 number you can call, or you can do it through the email. And basically you are providing information, which we're going to give that information on the next slide, on the overpayment that your organization has identified. And then you have 60 days to work this and submit the information. So some of the information that's required on the remedy ticket is basically your plan name, your contract levels, if you have any parent organizations, the reason, what was it? What is the reason for the overpayment that you're reporting at this point? And the explanation for inaccurate payment data. If you have the ability to do an estimate of what you think that overpayment is based on the model that you're sending for, they like that. That's not required. And any supporting documentation. As soon as you click this button and you put this information in your remedy ticket, your plan, your organization has 60 days to submit the deletes, the files, the erroneous data, whatever you want to call it. Go ahead. Excuse me.
Okay, so just for clarification, if it's after the calendar year closes, you can only send in those overpayments when CMS opens the window, correct?
Correct.
So you can't just Although do it whenever you want. It's after they send the HPS memo and say this calendar year is now open for overpayments
For a rerun.
Okay.
Is there any, do you have any experience otherwise? Because it's not 100% clear, I think most plans are actually following that guidance. you're pretty safe with that guidance. But under the False Claims Act, it says at any time. Any time outside of applicable reconciliation periods. So once those risk adjustment payment periods are closed out, then go
right.
ahead.
So the that notice comes out, and it's basically to answer the earlier question that on this date we are sweeping data up through here, and then you'll get you'll see the adjustment after that. But the when
60
they come out,
days after,
right? Yeah. I just wanted to clarify something. My understanding from the regulation was your 60 days begins on identification of an overpayment rather than opening up of a ticket. I know there's been a few cases, and I think some of them are still outstanding. And it's different for health plan data versus like a provider and the overpayment process they have to go through.
Correct. So how do you identify that and document it? And so a couple of the plans that I've worked with that have actually gone through this process and working with CMS, CMS has told them opening the remedy ticket, reporting it is your 60-day time to start. I always am of the opinion, and this is just my personal, from personal experience working in Medicare risk adjustment for the past 14, 15 years, is as soon as you know something, act on it. Don't be an ostrich. Don't stick your head in the sand. Don't be a partner in crime of reckless disregard, right? Apply or self-report yourself and move forward with it. And CMS is, from experience, they're pretty good about working with you if you are trying to do the right thing. If you're not, that's a different story.
Okay, my question is, when CMS comes out and says, all right, we're opening this prior period now for the next whatever time limit, does that mean plans should go back and sit there and create a process and just start pulling records either randomly or targetedly for those dates of service and start calling providers, getting the charts, reviewing and going through this whole process? Because
that's one way you could do it, but there's several ways that you can do this. And so I'm going to get into a little bit of mitigating the risk in this process, because we went from, these sweep periods and RADV to now, you have a reasonable due diligence to actually self-report at any time. So how do you do that without opening up yet another project and more cost to your plan? And that's a great question.
Right, because, some of the plans, we don't have a lot of resources, and we're struggling keeping up with our regular work. So I know for the one period, we went back and we created a process to look at it, and we did find some stuff that we submitted. But then the next one opened up, and it was like, we couldn't get what we already had on our plate done. And so we're like, we didn't create an audit process for that period. But is CMS expecting you to say, all right, for each one of these, I'm going to go ahead and create a new audit SWAT team to go after it?
CMS is expecting that you provide, as they say, reasonable diligence to make sure that everything you have submitted is accurate. Are they telling you that you have to have audit programs and mechanisms to do this? No. There's no governance and there's no rule that says you must have these set up. However, with that said, I think once your risk adjustment departments get rolling and we go through, let me go through the slides. I think I'm going to answer your question a little bit. And if not, we'll take some more questions at the end, but I don't want to go over, so I want to be cognizant of this. So some of the areas of overpayment risks are your submission errors, information getting through, your labs and diagnostics information getting through when it shouldn't, the filters, and the filters I'm talking about here and we'll go into a little bit are your new filtering system that CMS is imposing on the EDPS side. They're applying the filters. And then coding errors. And those are things that we find by looking at data and looking at records and seeing how providers actually code and document. So we can talk about submission errors. Here we have again Kane versus the State of New York. It was a systems glitch that actually caused data that was erroneous, that was not valid to filter through and for payment. And so really, it could be a big deal, especially if you're working with vendors or you have a process in-house and you aren't exactly sure how to apply a certain piece of information appropriately. And then we have discrepancy between the EDPS and the RAPs. RAPS versus EDPS. So EDPS, as we know, is a lot more complicated than the risk adjustment processing. In RAPS, the Medicare Advantage organization actually applies their own filters based on how their provider groups and their network actually bill. And there's some different nuances through billing and different ways that they use CPTs. And so they have the ability or the latitude to do that themselves. The data set that we send is much more simple. It's got 5, 6, 7 pieces of data only. And then the replies, the information that comes back from CMS that tells us what was accepted and what wasn't, is much faster. It comes within days, if not within 24 hours. With EDS, as a lot of you are experiencing at this point, CMS is determining, they're putting in a one-size-fits-all filter. So they're saying, this is what we're going to apply, and all of these CPTs are going to risk adjust. This is how we're doing it. We're using an 837 format that has 1,700 fields, and 100 of those fields are now required. And our replies, the information that we get back from CMS telling us what is actually accepted in risk adjusting, can take up to a week, but most of the time we get an RA response on a monthly basis. And I just want to plug something in here because EDPS is a big topic and it's new and there's a lot of information. We do have a white paper available for you today that you can pick up in the back of the room. It's great reading. Or they're on the tables. They're somewhere. But there is a great, I helped with that white paper. I was not the brain behind it, but I did help. It's a good, I had to read a lot, so it's a good piece of information. Anyway, so when we talk about deletes and overpayments, in RAPS you only have to delete one cluster, okay? In EDS, every claim, every diagnosis has to go back in and get deleted out. So you have to also use, in the regular open period, you're going to use a replacement claim or a chart review delete to attach to your EDS files and send that in. So the ability to easily and readily develop a delete file and send it through EDS is not going to be that easy anymore. Deleting from RAPS does not delete automatically from EDS and vice versa. And so you really have an overpayment risk if you're deleting on the RAP side right now, and you're not making sure that all of those diagnoses and dates get deleted on the EDS side as well. I feel like I sound like really horrible, guys. Hold on. It's not a good time to be sick. Okay. So we delete diagnosis via EDS through linked chart. That's one way you can do that. You want to diagnosis only deleted for that specific encounter. That's for RAPS. You cannot delete if it's linked to an ICN, and we don't delete diagnosis from any other encounters, and those can result in overpayments. So here's an example. A member is seen by 3 different providers on the same data service, and we find that the diagnosis code that the provider reported is invalid. On the RAP side, we only have to delete it one time, one transaction. Done. On the EDS side, we have to delete 3. We have to delete each provider, each encounter on the same date with the same diagnosis that's invalid, all need to go through. Here's another impact. And so, you know, looking at your data, doing chart reviews, or looking at your RAPS replies, maybe there's a 70-year-old male who started with just a demographic risk score, and in the calendar year, this member has cancer, diabetes, and cirrhosis of the liver. How these diagnoses got reported, though, are at odds with each other. So you can see from this case study that from the RAPS data, the cancer and the diabetes were reported. And from the EDS data, the diabetes and the cirrhosis were reported. So where we have a conflict now through our EDS and our RAPS systems, our submission systems, is the cirrhosis and the cancer. It may be an overpayment issue, it may not, but either way, with the blending of RAPS and EDS, this is something that you want to build into your audit process to determine, do we have an overpayment issue and do we need to delete some of these diagnoses, the cancer or the cirrhosis, or do we actually have a delta in how we're going to get paid in this blended model, and we need to correct that as well. So setting up a program to be able to look at this data and review it, it's really important. Coding errors is another area that puts us at risk for overpayment. And so we all know this, especially you coders in the room. Providers sometimes don't understand conventions, or their documentation doesn't actually support the code the appropriate way that they're submitting, and those put you at risk of overpayment. Using history of codes incorrectly. So maybe a member has a history of of a cardiovascular accident, a stroke, but the provider is still actually reporting that code. He's writing history of, it happened 2 years ago, there's no residual history of, and he's still putting through that code. And then acute codes being reported in office settings. And so flag for CMS, flag for any auditors. Acute codes, generally speaking, especially in the HCC model, don't happen in the office. You're not usually getting, you know, fresh traumatic amputation in your office, for example. And then filters. So we're talking about different types of filters. We talked about sending through wrong data, the labs and radiology that Rick spoke to earlier. But we also have this issue now with CMS applying their own filters for the EDS side. And we have experienced through our analysis and working with clients that there's about 100 gray codes. There's CPT codes that, generally speaking, on our master data filtering logic, we don't include. Because experience has told us that these codes are usually not completed by a provider source that's acceptable. And so some of these, of the 100 as example, is the venous puncture, the nurse visits, 9211, which a provider could actually submit, but generally speaking, they don't. They go for a little bit higher, a little bit more skin in the game. And your telehealth. And telehealth is a whole new area that's popping up all over the country, especially with plans who have providers in rural areas where they're actually providing services via the telephone. And so you want to make sure that encounters make it through with a diagnosis that they're truly supported, and that we have... the deletes and wraps are actually accounted for in EDPS and vice versa, and that any of the gray area codes that you may see that you're receiving risk adjustment funds for, you have a process, again, just to make sure, some sort of process to flag these CPTs and look at the records to make sure that they actually are real. Oops, I want to hit that middle button. And this is just a big litany on the filtering logic. And the use of procedure codes, which we already went over, and that it's just a recap. I'm going to go on. I want to talk about how we mitigate the risk for overpayments. And really, this is broad in general, because if you do these things inside your organization, you're going to actually mitigate your risk for RADV exposure. You're going to mitigate your risk for, you know, overpayment in the long run, and violating the False Claims Act, which is a big deal. So we're going to start with quality and compliance program. And this is some people say, yes, we have it, but it starts and stops with their coding and their compliance. I'm talking about developing a corporate compliance program and quality program that actually looks at overpayments and is in charge of overpayment processes when they occur and how to handle them and how to document them appropriately, report to CMS, et cetera. Documenting a process for operational activities. You've got audit activities, you have tracking data, you have reporting, submitting, and then just general legal compliance. And then revenue forecasting and reconciliation of future payments, because now what do? You got an overpayment, how is it going to hit your bottom line, and when are you going to expect to see that, and what's it going to look like? Do you need to put reserves, as Rick said, or what do you need to do? And we put together a task force, and this is just an example of the different people that should be involved, or the different departments that should be involved in your task force. And so you've got finance RA. If you have actuaries or you work with actuaries, they're good people to have, at least to be part of that sometimes. Your compliance coding, your legal, medical management. This is usually a medical director, but it could also be... just directors of medical management attending as well. And then your IT, because IT is really important in our process, working with vendors, submitting data, and et cetera. So this is the type of an example of a type of overpayment committee that I recommend you put together. And once you do that, then you need to have an ounce of prevention because it's worth a pound of cure, and develop a complete strategy of oversight that includes your risk adjustment strategies, conducting continuous data review at different levels, validate your submitted diagnosis codes. That's with retrospective review and even concurrent review, if you have the ability to do that. Perform targeted audits. And that's going back and looking at gaps in care. And we'll talk about all of this a little bit separate. And then education, educating your providers. Because, again, that's a big part of an ounce of prevention right there. So auditing. What type of auditing should you do internally? Definitely if you're working with vendors, you want to understand, A, what type of compliance that they govern themselves with, what their error rates are. Are they doing quality audits on their own paths, and what does that look like? You want to monitor them. So here I talk about the different types of vendors and prospective vendors. Going ahead and making sure that you understand how they're accessing their members, what type of codes that they're actually sending through, and if those codes are, you know, individual codes that never go through any other time, they just pop up all of a sudden, it's putting you at risk. So really looking at those codes that are outliers. And then your retrospective vendors, same thing. Do IRRs. Make sure that your retrospective vendors, very important, are not only looking for those additional codes that have been missed that actually can be put through for additional funding, but make sure that they're looking the opposite way and setting up a process to identify those codes that maybe were submitted, and now looking at the record, they do not comply. They will not validate. And target audits. So an example is using your data analytics to identify codes and coding frequencies and place of service and type of bill where they're coming from, and make sure that you take samples of those codes and go in and double check records and document the results. And if they don't pass, go ahead and submit them as deletes. So again, I have an example of traumatic amputation. I like that one for some reason. I'm hooked on amputations. But ulcers, you know, things that should resolve. he's laughing at me. I don't know. I do. I get stuck in this traumatic amputation thing. But at any rate, ulcers or diagnoses that aren't chronic, that things that should resolve. One area of interest, and I think I don't know if anybody's had any experience with it, but your protein-calorie malnutrition. This is something that they sometimes, providers tend to keep coding, and it's really actually resolved, or coders like to code, and they take lab results from a while ago to providers and say, you can code this, and really it was an intermittent issue. So that's another example. So a review of processes and database. At least annually, you should look at your internal processes around your risk adjustment activities and the strategies that you all employ. You should have policies, procedures written. Being a registered nurse, I think I'm kind of big on that. But I think it's really important to show that you are practicing the reasonable diligence of making sure that you try to comply with all of these regulations set forth. So take some time and, as a task force, review your internal systems and review what types of policies, what types of audits you're doing, what types of error rates you have. Certainly, if you have areas with higher error rates, you're going to want to address that through education and possibly doing a targeted audit around that as well. Make sure you have ongoing oversight on your vendors, and not just when you employ them or contract with them, if you continue and you keep renewing, you know, annually, because things change. Things change in the industry. You want to make sure that your vendors are staying up on all the regulations and changes and not putting your organization at risk. And then develop new policy as needed. And that's usually your compliance task force working together as well. And then we have risk score reconciliation. So on your submission side, reconciling your risk score, especially right now with a RAPS to EDPS. Does your RAPS diagnosis equal your EDPS diagnosis? are your wraps that are stored in your MEO4s matching each other, and then determine why they don't match. So you're going to have to do some sort of analysis. It's a lot of data. There might be some extra research. You may have to develop new business rules around this process. Just make sure that you take a look. And so I'm going to pull a case study with this. And I'm going to tell you that from our experience in working with some clients recently, with the first run of the MEO4s, we saw error rates between the wraps and the EDS side pretty high at about 10 to 15%. But with the second round now, that's come down a little bit. And so we're still seeing, though, discrepancy error rates about 5 to 7%. This is a type of analysis that you might put together to help you determine where your revenue is coming from. And here we do a little bit of forecast with 2015, 16, 17 blending of the payments. And then where we have wraps and EDPS only. Where the HCCs, how many members there are and how many HCCs there are, where they match perfectly. And then a bucket where we find them only on the wrap side. In a bucket where we find them only in the EDS side. So our buckets, EDS and wraps only, those are our buckets to go look at to make sure that we are not falling out of compliance and in an overpayment process. Also, at the same time, if we're not and they're in EDS only, we're shortchanging ourselves, right? So CMS isn't saying, hey, get as much funding as you can. They're just saying, make everything as accurate as possible. And so this is part of doing that and making sure that you understand what you're submitting and where it's all coming from, where it's going. I still want to press that middle button. So then you're going to resolve and report. You want to use dashboards to present to your CFOs, your COOs, your CMOs. They like that kind of stuff. It's a quick glance. Helps them understand what's going on and where there might be outliers and potential problems. You want to track and complete or rejected claims and items. And then you want to prioritize based on your actual business rules in your organization. Excuse me. We want to make sure that you guys are wary of not reporting. So payers are mandated by CMS to report accurate risk adjustment data. And I have wraps here, but it's now wraps and EDS. During those open submission periods. And so part of that process should be sending with your add files and your supplemental data, you should be sending deletes because there is no perfect process. In doing that in your open submission periods, you're going to be doing what? You're going to be setting processes and checks and balances that help prepare you better for a RADV and keep you out of an overpayment pending issue. With the false violation of the False Claims Act. RADV risk may increase by not reporting, and so that's for sure, so yes. Behind you.
Quick question on this. You mentioned EDPS is part of RAPS. You know, they've got the selection.
Sure.
And that is very much true because once a year, we have to sign an attestation on wraps that we're doing everything appropriately and going and getting the information. And I know this last time around for last year when we did this, I brought it to the attention that, okay, EDPS is in there. And I went to CMS and I put in a Q&A to find out if on that attestation, EDPS is part of it for wraps. And yes, it is. According to CMS.
It is. And so one of the things that I did, I just realized in all my glory of cold medicine and everything mm-hmm. else up here, I failed to tell you guys that the 2014 overpayment rule for risk adjustment, it also, there's new verbiage in, I want to say either June or September memo from CMS that says for 2015 payment year and on, you better be doing this also for your EDS data. But, so it applies to both.
But my question is,
all the way across the board,
is for signing off on that attestation RCFO looks, I was raising red flags because my concern was we are developing our EDPS process and we have elected not to use a vendor so we'd have it all done. And we have made great strides with it. But one of the things that they have not finished because they're currently working on submitting for, you know, record chart reviews. We have not done deletes yet, which is the next thing up on the process. So how do you sign off on an attestation when you know you're not doing deletes on the EDPS? And in my mind, I'm saying, hey, I don't recommend signing. I think you need to take this up to our plan manager and ask it. And nobody, including our compliance, they're like, Rick, no, you're missing. And I don't know what the right answer is. I'm not a lawyer, but if you guys have a better idea, I'd love to know.
I agree with you. However, then you're going to hold up everything. So you need to sign those attestations to get that data through and get the funding. But I think, again, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, and having a system in place, a policy in place that says, you know, we are still working on this, and these are our intentions. Here's our policy. We will go back by such and such date and do a full review and report. It's really that simple. It's just being straightforward. We don't have the answers for everything, and neither does CMS. Look at all the struggles that they're going through. And like I said, I've been doing this since 2000, and before it kind of started when we knew it was happening, since late 2003. It's all over the board, and 9 times out of 10, everything that I've dealt with CMS with, if I was able to say, this is what we do, this is how we handle it, here's the gray zones, they've been really good. They've been really good about it. So it covers your bases.
Some of my worries away.
Covers your bases. I'm sorry, did you have a question? Did you have something?
Yeah, just had some feedback.
Because really we're done.
So we had a scenario just like he's describing, and it's the deletes that I was talking about. It was the deletes that I asked you about. And so what happened was we became aware of the deletes that we had to do about 2 weeks before the attestation came to be signed, and everybody knows you have a certain amount of time to do that. So we were able to scramble, open the ticket, and include that ticket number in our attestation,
mm-hmm.
letting CMS know that we had identified some erroneously
errors.
Submitted
yeah.
diagnosis codes, and that seems to have done, to have worked.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing I'll add is when you follow up with MAPD, where you open the ticket,
mm-hmm.
they don't know anything other than they referred the ticket to the payment operations department. And when you call them...
I've heard that.
Yep. And when you call them, they don't know anything until they get the schedule of when they're going to do the overpayment run.
Did you have a question in the back? A comment? So these are just some frequently asked questions. And so when is it due? It's due after you identify it. But you're actually not really paying money to CMS. CMS is going to adjust the funds out. And supposedly, my understanding is after CMS processes the overpayment and does the adjustments, you will see it in the normal risk adjustment cycle, and it should show up on your MMR. It's supposed to happen 60 days after, but I don't think that that's really happening. Do we need a separate remedy ticket for each year of service? Yes, and each plan number, each H number is going to require one as well. Do we report every date of service that is not correct? Unfortunately, yes. And for EDPS, it's a little bit more complicated because it's every single encounter, too. And do we have to report overpayments if the HCC is covered by other diagnosis in another place of service? No, because it's not then an overpayment. If you have a valid supporting document somewhere for that HCC, unless you guys have a low tolerance for risk and it looks iffy, you might want to report it. But if it looks like a good, solid documentation, you do not need to report it. And do we need a remedy ticket for EDS? Yes. And initially when they came out with this remedy ticket process, CMS was asking that you attach that remedy ticket number to every file that you send to CMS, and they're not requiring that anymore. You can send your deletes through your normal procedure files. I think you mark it with a D for delete on a CCC format, and then it can go through. And you can still use an overpayment file as well, but putting that tracking number on there isn't required anymore. But definitely I would have, documentation within your organization, hopefully your compliance task committee, when you found this, who reported it, what date, that ticket number, and cover your bases. Keep it documented. Keep it safe. Okay, does anybody have any questions? Here's references, just in case you want to check me.
Questions for Denise?
It's my understanding that there's a difference in terms of consequences for an audit between a diagnosis that was captured on a claim and one that was captured through retrospective review. And my understanding is that if CMS finds one of those deficient, then retrospective review would have greater consequences in terms of penalties, et cetera, because that's within the control of the plan. The plan discerned that diagnosis, captured that, and submitted it to CMS. This is guidance I received recently from an attorney who specializes in this. It doesn't look like you agree with that, but just let me finish the question for one moment. If you do sympathize with that position, then have you seen plans differentiating between the two in terms of their compliance or risk mitigation focuses? And do you think CMS would appreciate, I guess, a higher prioritization on the retrospective review deficiency as opposed to the claim submission deficiency?
That's interesting. I have not. Has anybody else heard that? That there's a different focus? CMS is clear about one thing, and this is all I really know. The plans are mandated to submit accurate data. So we know that the data goes through. It goes through different ways. We may even know about ghost HCCs. Did any of you have experience with ghost HCCs? We don't know, how did they come? How did they get here? They just all of a sudden show up on an MMR, and you're like, this person, you take it to the doctor, and they're like, never, ever, ever. This person's been my patient for 30 years. It's our responsibility to get rid of that ghost HCC, okay? So that's all I know. A legal take on it, that's interesting. And I suppose within each organization, one of the things that you all are going to have to do is, identify your tolerance for risk, what that risk is, where that risk lies, and build policies around it. And then deal with CMS in regards to how you set up your organization. Being a nurse, I'm kind of hyper-vigilant about things, and so I just say, if the rule is try to get it as accurate as possible, and we have all these different reporting periods to get it accurate, work to get it as accurate as possible. It's all important, and it's all, at the end of the day, the information that filters through, yes, you get paid on it, but at the end of the day, that's somebody's health care. That's their record. And this information can really drive quality of care to the member at the member level. And it could hurt them, too, if not reported appropriately. So that's my little quality of care soapbox.
One more question right here.
Yep.
No,
go ahead.
It's just a comment. I think this question was indirectly addressed in the coding session this morning, where most plans agree that if you fully disagree with what was submitted, you know it's wrong, you are going to reverse it. However, if we are in the gray area, we're not going to touch it. But if it was not submitted already, we're not going to submit it as part of retrospective review. However, if it was submitted in this gray, we leave it alone.
Sure.
Thank you.
All right, gang. So, Rick, Denise, thank you very much. It was a really nice hour.
I'm sorry. I have one more thing. I forgot to take a little bit of housekeeping. I am actually going to be doing a webinar on this on February 22nd. I think at 2 in the afternoon. I'm a salesperson, 2 in the afternoon. I don't know the time. But if you want to get a rerun of this with a lot more information, it's probably about 25 slides longer with more analytical data information, please join. I'd love to have you.